Hey everyone, this is Surya. Thanks for listening to ABCD Politics, explanation of the name at the end. Before I bring Razib in here to join me, just wanted to issue a trigger warning that there's enough here to upset most people on the left and the right, and I think that's sort of the point, is just to listen to where other people are coming from and different points of view than we normally hear. I think it's more important to listen now than ever. Look, just because I say something and Razib doesn't agree with me, but doesn't say anything, doesn't mean he agrees, and vice versa. I think there's a lot that I wanted to push back on, but there's not enough time. And I think they're valid points since he believes it, and vice versa. So hope this goes well. This is the first episode, and hopefully it'll get better from here. Thanks for listening.
Hey Razib, how are you?
I'm okay. Yeah, I'm okay.
Yeah, I think that's the best any of us can say right now.
We live in interesting times.
You know, you come at this, I think, from, if you had to pick a camp, the right, and I come at it if I had to pick a camp from the left, ideologically. So I thought it'd be interesting for us to.
Well, you know, I want to say one thing for listeners that I found fascinating. So you know, I think I'm a little older than you. We're about the same age, okay? But I remember the 1980s, the 1990s. And when I was a kid, my family's from Bangladesh, so I'm not going to tell kids and people in the 1980s that I'm from Bangladesh because they don't know where that is. So I just say, by India. And they would ask me, well, what tribe are you? So that's a new discussion. I mean, but this was 1987. This is my daily life. I feel like in the 21st century, things have really changed a lot. I don't get told that it's amazing that I speak English the way, right, I speak it. You know, I don't get asked where I'm really from. Things have changed a lot. This week, with the riots, I feel erased from the narrative. There's black people and there's white people. And they're doing this thing and they're resolving this history. And we're gone. We're just gone from the narrative. And so my wife was saying this because she saw a... she saw a Facebook message from a progressive white liberal friend about how they need to support melanized people. That's literally the word she used. But in any case, and so I reached out to some, as they say, BIPOC now, BIPOC, friends of mine. They're Asian, though, of Asian origin, East, South Asian, mixed Eurasian. And I direct messaged them and I said, am I the only one that feels erased right now? It's as if there's only black people, only white people. And one of my friends, I messaged six of them, said, my wife said that to me today. It's like we're erased. So I just want to put that out there for the Asian American listeners. I think a lot of us feel like, whoa, like we're not part of this story. This is a 400-year-old story. They're talking about, 1619 project, 400 years. We're not part of that story. So that's one thing that I am definitely feeling right now.
Look, my reaction to that is twofold. One, certainly I remember the 80s, unfortunately. I remember the 90s even more, unfortunately, because of Apu. And I feel like in New Jersey, in the early to mid 90s, it was especially nasty to not just, say, hey, we'll try, that stuff's felt harmless. The worst was sort of Ginder, Dothead, go back to India. You smell like curry, all that stuff. Right. So certainly, and it's something I'm actually writing about now for mm-hmm. this collection of essays, things have changed immensely in my life as far as the racism that I face. Some of that is class. Some of that I think is just that part's gotten better. So I agree with you there on this sort of erasure. I'm not there with you. I think one, this is about black people specifically. Look, I've never met you in person, so I don't know how your Pantone color compares to mine, but I'm very dark skinned. And I face certainly some harassment and the like, especially from cops, good cops, bad cops, but the bad cops, certainly some shitty treatment. But you know what? It was almost that treatment, because eventually or immediately, whatever, they realized I'm not black. Hmm. And so they treated me, whatever their
false
first
positive, impression. False positive.
False positive. Yeah, exactly. Age of COVID, that's relevant. But, this is about, you know, to me, our Black brothers and sisters. And like you said, this goes back hundreds of years. It is a white Black narrative right now. But I think the reason for that is because the most of the people who are angry that people are protesting or, you know, using the riots and the looting, which is a part of the protests and is really unfortunate, you know, and certainly I'm not going to defend that. But we're using that to say, hey, this is despicable. This is whatever has turned this into more a Black white issue. I think most of the folks who I see who are sort of, you know, on the margins of the discussion, like us, are allies of the Black community. You know, like Ravel in I think that's his name in DC, who let those people into his house, the protesters, and elsewhere that I just see in my feed. So look, I understand what you're saying. It's just, I think I view it through a different lens of certainly I'm not offended by it. And it makes sense to me why it is the way it is. If that makes sense to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't use the word ally because that has particular connotations on the left. And so I'm literally an ally, but I don't use that. It's like saying the way I explain it to my liberal friends is like, if in the 1990s someone came up to you and were like, you support family values, right? A lot of liberals would be like, I don't really want to say yes to that because I support family values, but that has certain connotations.
Right.
Okay? When you say social justice, right? Okay. Who's opposed to social justice? But I'm not going to say I support social justice because that means a whole lot of things for you guys, you know? Like you've owned that, right? It's like I was talking to a liberal friend of mine. When I see the word liberty, I know that's a conservative person. When I see the word justice, I know that's a liberal person. But do conservative people oppose justice and do liberal people oppose liberty? They don't.
Sure.
But they've owned those words. So anyway, I just want to put that out there. There's all sorts of.
So I agree with you. I agree with your point, and certainly I think it speaks to how divided we are and how tribal we are. But what's your point with that? Like just that.
Just my point is like when liberals say ally of the Black community, they mean they don't mean it in the generality. They mean a lot of specific policy points. So for example, I have academic friends, and I think they're being hyperbolic. They're angry. But they are saying they believe police should be abolished. Now that's one end of the spectrum, right? But there's been a lot of hatred and anger towards the police, and some of that is justified. Let's be frank.
So you say, if you say, hey, if I say I'm an ally, I'm being lumped in to supporting, hey, abolish the police and all this other stuff, and that's why you hesitate and you don't use that word. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I would say that's an extreme. Yeah. That's an extreme position. Most people don't want to abolish the police. On the other hand, there is an undercurrent of hostility towards the police, and I want to take a neutral. Most of the protesters, the vast majority of the protesters, I suspect, I haven't done any research on it, so I don't know for sure. I suspect they're not looting, but there are some people that are looting, and that's bad, right? The vast majority of police.
Of course.
I suspect don't beat people, but a minority do. And so therefore, I don't want to make blanket judgments on a whole class of people. And I'm seeing that happen.
Of course. So, hey, basically we've already started, but, you know, I think the broadest question here is given, you know, how you approach this, how do you view the, you know, like I think you just aptly pointed out, the verbiage here is charged. So how do you view the protests, riots, you know, however you want to call them, demonstrations. How do you view what's happening might be the best way to say it.
I support the right to protest. I think it's important. I think protesting can change things and it can raise consciousness. I have no problem with the protest. I have issues with Black Lives Matter in a lot of details of their policy, but in general, I support their rights. And I also support the general issue that they're bringing up with violence and brutality, the capriciousness of law and law enforcement. Okay, the riots, I totally oppose. I am disgusted by people like Hannah Nicole Jones, I think, at the New York Times, saying, "Well, it's not violence if it's against property." So if I went to Hannah Nicole Jones and I took her out of her house, took her kids out of her house, took her husband out of her house, and burned down her house? Have I not done violence to her? You know, I mean, this sort of stuff, like, is enraging a lot of conservatives because it's sophistry. It's just semantic wordplay. Just own that as an unfortunate side.
You're going to have to define sophistry for me.
I'm going to have what?
You're going to have to define sophistry for me.
And maybe sophistry is just like, it's like, it's like using words to redefine things in a way to kind of obscure the issue, right? Okay. So when you say, for example, some people say, well, you're creating trauma on someone by those ideas, you're causing violence. Okay, like you're redefining what violence is, and you're kind of making the word violence do work for you. When you say burning down a building is not violence, okay, like removing that word is doing work for you in terms of kind of mitigating it. So for example, it didn't turn out that Notre Dame, I believe it didn't turn out Notre Dame was arson, but they suspected it. If Notre Dame, the burning of Notre Dame had been arson, is that not violence? Because the building, it's property, it's not a person. I mean, I think we know that this is just I don't know why they're even saying this, because on the face of it, it just doesn't seem plausible to me, and it angers a lot of people. Now, killing people is worse than killing property, right? But a lot of times people are in property. So I don't understand the logic of that. I don't understand it. So if you can explain it to me.
I don't support riots, period, or looting, certainly not looting. I think it's there's here in New York, like around Fifth Avenue, the last couple of nights I didn't check. This is pretty early in the morning, before 8 a.m. on Tuesday that we're recording this. Or Wednesday that we're recording this. So I don't know what's happened Tuesday night, but Monday night, Sunday night, there was some rioting along Fifth Avenue. Entire stores open, emptied out, and the like, and reports of people who, like, cars pulling up at people, essentially organized looting. So look, that stuff, obviously horrible, ridiculous. And these people are essentially doing huge disservice, to, I don't think they're part of that cause, but if they were, they're, you know, essentially undermining it and doing more damage than any enemy of theirs ever.
I totally grant that they're opportunists. They don't seem like, frankly, I mean,
but
I think there's coordinated, like they know that they're going to get like iPads, like the stuff that I've seen recorded, right. Like they're going to resell that.
Distraction. So let's do this while everyone's distracted. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But my point is, look, I think where I and a lot of other people are sort of, I think it's incendiary, is this idea of people getting more upset about the destruction of property than about the systematic destruction of human life that's happened through police brutality. I'm almost 40. I know you're around that age. We've seen a lot of this throughout our lives, and always there's some protests, always people talk about it, and it seems to just keep happening. And now in this age of camera phones, we're seeing this pushed in our face more and more, and certainly I think COVID and all of us being cooped up and being stuck to our screens and watching this, not having sports, not having other distractions that we might normally have compelled more eyeballs than maybe normal. And I think enough, but I think it goes back to that central point of what's incendiary is this belief that there is a subsection, that there are these people who find the destruction of property more offensive, more of a problem than the destruction of life.
Yeah, I don't think that that's it. I mean, there are. Okay, when we make these generalities, like, we're going to have to, like, speak of most people in a given group, because there are people that are exactly what you're saying. I grant that, right? Just like there are leftist anarchists who are quite excited about the riot. In fact, I will tell you, this is just like a tangent. I follow a lot of academic Twitter, and there are graduate students who are saying that they're feeling really good watching banks and buildings burn. And they're saying this publicly on Twitter and getting accolades. So I understand they're young and immature and their thoughts are not well formed out, but, you know, people are saying that. So in any case, they're not everybody. They're not most people, you know?
I guess I'm not saying that's you, Razib.
No, I know. I'm saying, I'm saying that there's a certain perception. I don't think that perception's true. I think the issue here is people have a base rate bias where what's happening in the background doesn't shock them. And when there's something new, it shocks them. So, for example, 1,000 people a day are dying of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. Now no one bats an eye.
We're not talking about it. Are people not outraged by it? No, it's just our base rate, right?
Yep.
It's part of the background. And so I think that's what's happening. It's unfortunate, but it's real. You know, for example, like, you know, for all, you know, we're old enough to remember the Iraq War. Tens of thousands mm-hmm. of Americans died.
Yeah, I remember both of them.
Yeah. And after a while, it just gets like, you know, one death after the another. And so I think people, part of it is people are inured to it, but also like there's a salience, like there's certain things that are prominent to people because they're exceptional. So
when you say the basement and inured to it, you're talking about, hey, the systematic killing, of police brutality, right? That's become
part of it. It's part of the background.
Yeah, it just, I agree.
It crops up periodically.
Yep.
And then it kind of fades from the headlines. It's one of those things, you know?
Right.
And so now people are rioting. They're taking things in large numbers all across the country. There are people who are losing. And yes, like Target is going to survive because it's well capitalized.
Yep. But the family hardware may not.
No. And they're small business people, you know, they're done. They're going to go work at the mini mart now because, you know, they don't have. I mean, a lot of these are immigrants. They don't have English skills. They might not have the education. You know, being an entrepreneur was the way they made it in retail. They don't have that. They don't have the insurance, whatever. Stuff like that is happening. It's outrageous.
I just want to go back to that point you just said, because I think I think it will be insightful for anyone that does listen to this, because it's something, you know, for me that I said, okay, you know what, that is the first time something makes sense to me. I have been offended by this, you know, what I see is people calling out the destruction of property when not calling out the destruction of lives, or calling out the destruction of property before that, or calling out the destruction of property and then couching it in. Of course, I support the first free speech, but, you know, and. But, you know, your explanation of the base rate, you know, I can understand that. That at least is plausible to me, and it makes some sort of sense. And I think that's part of the problem, is that people are not hearing in these echo chambers. We don't hear things that explain. And that's why I wanted to say, hey, this is what I feel, and this is what I hear, and this is what makes others so incendiary. And hey, you've explained why. Hey, maybe, you know what? Maybe that could be misconstrued, right? I understand that you view it this way, but there's, you know, people are inured to it, and because of that, they're reacting to what's right in front of them, right? And saying this is painful, and you're causing harm. Look, that makes sense to me, man.
Well, so another thing that I would say is, I think, you know, we've discussed about the changes in this country. So racism is real; it exists. Like, I obviously acknowledge that, you know, I am, you know, a person of color myself, you know, so, and I've, you know, unlike you, I didn't grow up in New Jersey. I grew up in Eastern Oregon. So I have quite of a different experience, and, I have some stories I could tell you about that, but, you know, so I've seen so many changes over the last couple of decades, but, there's been a fair amount of social science evidence that white liberals in particular, have in the last 5 years perceived a massive spike in racism. And I don't think that that has any basis in reality. We don't know exactly what it's coming from, but I've had to, you know, I have a lot of my friends are in academia. Okay. And so they're very progressive, but somehow magically all their friends are white and all the people they know are white. And so I am the token non-white friend of these very progressive, racially liberal people.
Well, academia is overwhelmingly white, isn't it?
It depends on the area. So like, if you're talking about like neuroscience, there's a lot of people that look like us and a lot of other East Asians. But I know a lot of evolutionary ecology people. And for some reason, I don't know if they're white supremacists, but no, they're not. basically, if you tell Asian parents that you're going to go study ecology, they're not going to let you leave the house. We know that. Okay. So there are some reasons Asians don't go into ecology, but in any case, so, you know, they'll talk about how, you know, there's been this like massive spike in racism and like all of this stuff. And you know, how it was like so much better. And I don't usually comment on Facebook threads, but I've had to jump in. I'd be like, you know, as a non-white person, I can tell you the 1980s and the 1990s, it was way worse. So I understand what you're saying. I think it's wrong. There might be some spike due to Trump against the baseline of, say, 2013. I don't know. But no, I've seen huge changes over my own life. Let me give you an example. When I was in elementary school, my librarian, she fainted in the middle of the class. She had some health issue and she was fine, but her husband had to come to pick her up to take her home. And her husband, and you know, librarian was white. Her husband was black. And that was the talk of the class. That was the talk of the rest of the day. She had a black husband.
What grade?
I believe this was fifth grade.
Okay.
This was like 19, I don't know, it was in late 80s, okay?
It's an Oregon thing, because, you know, even in the 80s, that would not have been shocking in New Jersey.
Well, this was in upstate New York. It was in Albany.
Oh, interesting. Well, upstate Albany. New York.
Yeah, the class was about like 20% black, just so you know. So it was a racially diverse school. But I'm just saying that would not be, nobody would comment on it today. In most places, right?
Right.
So there's been like these huge changes. I'm in a mixed marriage, but I don't think of it as a mixed marriage. Honestly, race does not come up for me except for like when I live in an overwhelmingly white area. Most of these people don't know any people of color again. And so they will, you know, ask me about like, oh, do I experience a lot of racism? What is it like to be a non-white person? And I have to sometimes be like, okay, I just have not thought of that until you just brought it up. So you obviously see me and see a non-white person, and now I'm that's having to think.
But you understand that that's a very privileged position to live in, right? Like you know that that's not the norm for lots of people, right?
Well, so this is the interesting point. I'll give you an example. One of the, you know, we're more acquaintances, our wives are friends. He had some sensitivity training. And he talked about like, you know, racism and stereotypes and prejudice and so at a Christmas party, and you know, it was obviously talking about like, okay, like these are black people and this is what they experience. And he's like, you know, what's your experience? And I said, you know, I had to be honest. I said, in terms of stereotypes, I know I've gotten some software jobs because they just assumed I could do it. Mm-hmm. And one time I asked my boss, I'm like, how come you guys didn't like ask me to like give you a code sample? And they're like, yeah, we just looked at you and we could tell, you know.
Right.
He knows how to code. And so, I had to be honest. I'm like, you know, some of this stuff works in our favor. Sometimes it doesn't. But it's less complicated than just the word stereotype, you know, like the texture of reality. And I feel like, you know, from my perspective, people on the left today, even though they live a complex life, they speak in these like stark ways. And people on the right often do, too, when they talk about like liberty and socialism and all these things. And look, we know it's more complex than this. I mean,
right.
You
like,
know,
certainly we're polarized as a nation. No,
yeah.
World, no. But I want to go back just before we lose the thread on that. Like you started with something that I wanted to respond to, which was, you know, hey, like certainly I agree with the point that that racism has declined in overt racism in my lifetime that I've experienced. I can't speak for other people because look, I've not lived their lives, right? Like, but for me, what I've seen and witnessed and observed, it has certainly gone down towards the Indian American community. That's a great thing. And certainly, you know, since the 60s, my aunt and uncle came to Alabama in the early 60s and lived in Huntsville. He ended up getting his PhD and working for NASA and the like. But, you know, they remember open Klan meetings. They remember not being able to go outside except for a night, except for when the birth of their kids. They remember they were as afraid of the police as they were of anyone else because how many police were Klan members. So look, things have obviously gotten better. However, it goes back to your base rate thing. I think that since in the last three, 4 years, things certainly have felt like they've spiked. I do feel this weird tension, this weird, these looks, these things that I hadn't felt before. And look, some of that could be because of my own perception, right? Like I'm imagining it.
Mm-hmm.
But we have seen, you know, I haven't seen the academic study of these shootings and synagogues and hate crimes and the like. But from some of the articles I've read, there has been somewhat of a spike compared to the, you know, 40-year period, 5-year period before it. So I think it depends on the time horizon. So I think it goes back to your point around base rate and sort of whether or not we become inured, things sort of getting better. And then all of a sudden, when they take a little bit of a spike up, hey, that's going to be alarming because we don't want to go backwards. And so I understand sort of where they're coming from. But, certainly no one should say that, hey, it's going back to the bad old days because, look, we're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is due to just like, okay, like we have to deal with like overwrought rhetoric, you know, like, I mean, for example, like Biden said, was it 2012 campaign? He said, you know, he's telling a bunch of black people like, oh, they're going to put you back, y'all back in chains. Okay, like he didn't literally mean it, but like that sort of rhetoric is just like.
If there's a stupid thing to possibly say, Joe Biden said it.
That's, I can't refute that.
Okay.
So, but I mean, I was using him as like kind of an example where, you know, like let me give you an example of just the kind of thing that frustrates me when I was in graduate school. This is 2014, Obama era, you know, one of my lab mate, my desk mate, she was in the office of mine. We were good friends, and she's like a Southern California blonde, just to give you kind of paint a picture. And she, you know, I'm Republican, and she's like, why are you a Republican? They're racist. And, you know, we just have discussions and stuff like that. And then I went to her wedding. You know, most of the listeners know California is 50%, you know, less than 50% white. Her wedding was 95% white people. So I'm not making any judgments on her, but like, you know, this is a person who's telling me that, you know, the political party that I affiliate with is racist. And yet her wedding party does not look like, I mean, the wedding, the guests invited, the wedding party, it looks like Santa Barbara from like 1965. I mean, literally, you know? And, you know, she did tell me also privately once that she asked her dad to transfer out of a school that was like, you know, 70% Chinese American because she didn't feel comfortable being in, you know, the 30% minority white kids. And, you know, we're really good friends. So she was comfortable telling me this. Now me,
I hope she doesn't hear this podcast. She's not going to be happy with you.
Well, people won't be able to figure out who she is, but, I'm not that well known, you know, but, all I'm trying to say though is like, you know, I've been a minority my whole life. Right. So I was just like, okay, like you're 30%. Like I've been like literally the only brown kid, you know, and I'm okay with that. Like, you know, it's not a problem for me. All I'm trying to say here is like, you know, she felt comfortable accusing other people of racism, but I know the choices that she's made in her life. And I'm only highlighting her because they're normal choices. Most white people make that choice, whether they're, you know, like I was talking to a liberal academic friend and I was saying like, you know, my personal
hypocrisy or like, what are you getting at?
I'm getting at the fact that what people say, yes, it is hypocrisy. Right. And liberals and conservative white people, they're both racist. Conservatives might be somewhat more racist. But sometimes when liberals talk about racism, they talk about it as other people, those other white people, not white people like us. But they're part of the system, too. And this is what we're getting at, the systemic, you know, but sometimes you abstract it instead of making it concrete, unless it's that other group. Right. So when you see a bunch of white Republican congressmen, I hear a lot of liberals say, look at all those white guys. You know, but I mean, I see like a conference of scientists and literally every single person is white, like, but they're, you know, liberal dorks. So you're like, why are there like 70 people and 69 of them are white? You know, but if they were like, you know, evangelical Christian pastors, I'm sure you would point that out because those people are racist.
So I want to just take a second for our listeners, whoever they may be, to just say, like, you know, I think so much of this is about listening. And so I'm not going to, because we would just sort of not get anywhere and these episodes would have no kind of thread if I push back up against everything that I may not agree with or that, you know, and I think likewise from Razeeb to me. But this is about actually, you know, I think there's not much talking for people on the other side of the ideological spectrum, for people who may disagree with us. And so
this isn't crossfire.
Exactly. So I just wanted to flag that, hey, you know what, just because I don't say anything doesn't mean I necessarily agree with it. But you know, I'm gonna sort of pick and choose. And I know you're doing the same as far as what you hear from me that you sort of push back on or really want to press on versus versus, okay, look, I understand that that's what you believe. And okay, thanks for sharing that, you know, and hey, that's enlightening to know that that's what, that's how you view this. Right. And that's what upsets you. And this is what you believe when you hear this. So just as a sort of a narrator, 1,000 foot.
For sure.
Yeah. So just to go back to the events that are happening right now in the present, what's been the most surprising to you or the most disappointing?
The most surprising thing is, I've been surprised at the rioting, at the looting and the violence, because we have had these protests before and they've been peaceful. Okay. So that's one thing. I was surprised by that. I've been disappointed at the media because they were so contemptuous and condescending about social distancing. And I'm not just talking about the protests earlier, people in lockdown. And now they're keeping quiet, and I understand why they're keeping quiet. But it's interesting because the media,
I think it's the base rate.
Yeah, that's become sort of background. It's a base rate, right. Like, you know, some of the epidemiologists I know have been explicit, like, well, this is about, like, you know, 300 years of racism. This isn't about, like, getting a haircut. I think that's trivializing what some of the protesters were complaining about, because there's a lot of people in extreme financial stress of all races right now. And I think some of the earlier protests were saying, like, well, it's our freedoms and all this stuff. But really, they didn't have a job. You know, if they're usually the small business people, because there's unemployment for a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of things going on there. I was pro lockdown. I mean, I kind of still am, but obviously that's over. But now, you know, the media is keeping quiet and being respectful as people scream in each other's faces over and over. And I understand why but it's terrifying me, because that's the way it spreads. Like, you yell, you scream, you do these things. There's probably major spread going on. I understand there's a cost versus benefit. But the point that I would bring out here is, earlier when some people were saying, and I didn't agree with these people, but when some people were saying, well, there's an economic cost here, the media's response, the authorities' response, epidemiologists that I follow on Twitter were like, well, you know, lives, you can't put a cost on lives. Like, you know, we gotta focus on the lives. Now there's a social cost. The social cost is police brutality. Well, you know what? You know, forget the lives. The social cost is enough. All of a sudden, cost versus benefit comes into play, and people are saying,
"Well, okay, that social cost is also lives." But
yeah, that's what I'm saying, though. Social cost is lives. But I mean, the economic cost is also, you know, I mean, there were things. It's not just economic; it's public health. No. You know, sure. You know, we all know. I'm assuming we all know everybody who's delayed medical care. You know.
No, it's a fair point. I mean, there's a lot of that's why this stuff doesn't get talked about more broadly. I don't know that there's a grand conspiracy. It's because there's so much nuance to this. And I think, frankly, like, as a society, we don't do well with nuance. We don't want it. We don't really care about it. And that's why we retrench to these tribal sort of, you know, am I against you? Am I for you? You know, spare me the details. And so, you know, I understand a lot of what you just said. It makes some sense to me. And I know some people agree that makes sense to me.
You know, and I don't want to like even say is like our society uniquely. I think it's how humans process cognition. Yeah,
I mean, in the world society. Let me give
like a Brown example that some listeners might find interesting. You know, I when I was in high school, people thought I was Hindu because the way I look, because I look like a Hindu. You know, my family's Muslim, I'm atheist, whatever. So they would come up to me and talk to me about Hinduism because they'd heard about it in church because, you know, they've been taught about this like devilish cult called Hinduism. That's literally the way you would say it, you know? And so I would have to kind of like defend or, you know, I had to do it. Like, you know, it was just weird. Like, but that was the position I was in, you know? And so a friend of mine, and we were friends, he comes up to me and he's like, do you Hindus, like, you know, you Hindus believe that people become like that gods come into people. That's so weird. And I looked at him and I said, like Jesus?
Right.
And then he's just like, his jaw dropping, just walked off. Now, the issue here is like, he had not made the connection and the analogy because he was in his own little cognitive bubble.
Sure.
You know? And so the arguments and it was just so bizarre to him that Hindus thought that like gods could walk around. And he didn't realize he was in a church praying to a God that walked around. And so I'm only bringing that up in terms of you don't see something sometimes when you're too close to it. And I think that's what happens with all of our ideological bubbles.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, from my end, what's been inspiring has just been seeing, I've seen in New York City a lot of peaceful, so many peaceful protests. They're so young, so many young people, very peaceful. It's coming from a good place. And it's just so prevalent. It's happening all over the country. I saw this morning, Amsterdam, had a huge protest, I guess, and all over the world. So that to me is heartening that people are willing to stand together. And you know, frankly, one of the things that's concerned me so much is just apathy. It's just that, like, what do people care about anymore? And this is clearly against that. What's been disappointing and disheartening is certainly how quickly and how seemingly organized the looting and some of the violence, some of this Antifa, essentially, I think anarchists have taken over whatever was
Black Bloc.
Whatever these things are, I don't pretend to even have read any articles about them, so I don't know. But they certainly seem like anarchists, and you know, it's heartbreaking that hey, these black kids and these brown kids and whatever have to like disarm these anarchists and turn them over to police and all the rest, or these videos of these people saying hey, please don't burn that. No, you know, but that just how quickly it went to that, and how much some people. Mm-hmm. Screaming, you know, seemingly screaming for disorder and for anarchy and to tear everything down. You know, I get some of their anger maybe coming from a place of that's misguided, but maybe, you know, not evil, but just how quickly and how seemingly organized and widespread that is has certainly been disappointing.
Yeah. I have been. I don't know about inspired is the right word, but most people are peaceful. Most people care. Most people are good. Most people are doing the right things. It's just that there's a minority, and unfortunately it's a large coordinated, you know, large enough coordinated minority. So that's the bad half. You know, that's the glass half empty. The glass half full is that most people still have their heart in the right place, even though they're hurting, even though they're in intense economic stress. And you know, their communities are in stress, and we have the coronavirus pandemic. And another thing is, you know, it is disproportionately affecting the Black American community.
Oh yeah.
You know? So hugely. Yeah, it's a huge disproportionate.
Hispanic, here in New York, Hispanic as well, but yeah, hugely.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's, there's good and the bad, but I mean, honestly, it's, at this point, I mean, unfortunately, the good comes out of a reaction to the bad in this world of our broader social problems. And so I'm frankly bearish. I'm not pessimistic about this country right now. I just recorded a podcast.
Wait, before we get there, I just want to say one thing, just building off what you said. You know, I also think you said, hey, a lot of people, their hearts are in a good place. And I definitely see that. And I see that even among a lot of the diehard conservatives who I've agreed with on almost nothing, and both in my family and in, you know, just look, I lived in Ohio for many years. I know a number of conservatives. And, you know, unlike I think some of my friends who have sort of more lived in traditional sort of coastal bubbles, right? Who don't know, you know, who don't, you know, they have one conservative friend versus, you know, lots.
His name is Token.
Yeah, exactly. But my point is that I think I've seen a lot of these people. I think there's a real struggle with what's going on. On one hand, they recognize that there is this, like, look, this is a bad thing that happened and that's been happening. But then they're also torn by COVID, and, you know, these are not the, like, my friends and family are not the ones who think COVID some kind of conspiracy theory and, you know, and the like. And so they're concerned that this is going to lead to another outbreak, which I am too. But also, you know, just that they see the rioting and the unrest and they wonder, hey, is this the start of a spiral and all of the rest. And then there's sort of the extreme rhetoric coming from many, you know, the traditional left here, you know, and they feel, like you said, I don't want to identify with it. Like that's a bridge too far. And so they feel very, I think there's a lot of people with their hearts in a good place that feel very tortured. And I think for those listening who are very sympathetic, who empathize with the protesters who identify on the left or whatever, I think we should be thinking more broadly around how we include everybody and not radicalize such that, you know, hey, this is a purity test, right? This all turns into one, a bigger and bigger and bigger purity test. And in the end, we can't all unite, right? Towards actual some change against the systemic issue of police brutality and the reform that needs to happen.
I think that's true. I think, you know, in terms of not knowing people, one thing, you know, most of the people that I know in my real life in IRL are liberal. My wife is liberal, and you know, I was in academia until relatively recently, and I live in very liberal towns, so I am the token conservative quite often. But I do have a lot of conservative think tank friends. I've written for City Journal. I've written for National Review. I'm pretty well known in conservative circles. And one thing that I would tell you is, you know, I'm an atheist. I'm pretty socially liberal. But you know, I know traditional Catholics. I know all sorts of types of conservatives. One common thing is, whether you believe it or not, conservatives feel that the cultural hegemony of liberals of the left is such that basically, why are we on the right? We're just like, we don't want to be in re-education camps. Now, that sounds really hyperbolic, I think, to liberals, but that is our perception. And a lot of us, especially in the more like intelligentsia group, are surrounded by liberals and have to constantly defend our views. And so there's a level of just like defensiveness and paranoia that I think might be a little hard sometimes for people who are like, you know, coastal elites to really understand like where that's coming from. For conservatives that are like, you know, conservative Christians, they have their own institutions, but those institutions tend to be oppositional and kind of feel like they're, you know, just minority institutions against the hegemony, you know, that sort of thing. So you know, there's a lot of paranoia.
Sure. Both sides feel that paranoia and oppression, because I feel that too. I mean, as much as I think I have many progressive values, much more of my voting Democratic, especially of late, has been because I think the right has just turned batshit crazy and has abandoned principles. And that drives me much more than these progressive values of late. Just because, you know, I've been a registered Democrat twice in my life. One year 2010 when I ran for Congress and I had to vote for myself, or I didn't have to, but or maybe I did in order to get on the ballot. But you know, I voted for myself in the primary, and then I registered as a Democrat this year because I wanted to say, although it's all done, as to who is going to be against Trump, because it's just you know, I'm just so horrified that I was like, there's no point in me keeping this. You know, my disgust, the reason I was never a registered Democrat is because I've been disgusted with both parties and my the like. But so I think that's on both sides.
I think, you know, when you said like the lack of principles, I think one of the issues that happens is ultimately, like tribalism is beyond principles. It overrules principles, right. You know, like if you're principled, that, you know, one thing I do have to say is I get along quite well with many people on the far left. And one reason is because when you're that far left, your principles are very strong and you will say things that are quite. So one thing, I was talking to a far left friend of mine once as in like 2 years ago, I was shocked at the turn towards Russophobia, basically anti-Russian racism on some on the moderate left. When the resistance after the 2016 election. Now, I understand that there was the issue with the Russian interference. That was legit. But I saw, like, you know, real, like, prejudice against Russians, whereas, like, they were suspicious of Russians. And my far-left friend said the exact same thing. He was shocked, too, because he's like, wait a second. You're against prejudice, but you're being prejudiced against Russian people because of this whole political thing. And I'm just pointing that out in terms of, like, that was tribalism, because those same people in 2012 were probably laughing at Romney for being suspicious of Russia and saying that he was bigoted. But they turned on a dime because their tribalism was driving them in that direction. Now, if you're far left, like socialist, you're not really big into tribes, because why are you being so marginal anyway? You know? And so with those people, they tend to be more
on the right. Like I'll give a plug for my boy Justin Amash, you know, from who I know you know of, right? Like, I don't know him actually.
Yeah.
He ran the same year that I did. Yeah. You know, he was elected as part of the Tea Party, but he's, you know, seemingly the only one who has been ideologically completely consistent the entire time as a true libertarian. And it's remarkable to me just that, like, there's only one.
That's fair. I mean, there's some that, like, that kind of make motions in that direction, but ultimately... Ultimately, they're politicians. Amash is a person.
Right. He is. And I give him a ton of credit. And I, you know, I disagree with him on a lot, but I've always said, hey, you give me someone who I can trust and who I believe in is actually principled. And I'll take that, not, you know, 10 out of 10, you know, and 11th on Sunday or however that phrase goes. But
yeah.
Hey, how do you, I don't want to, I think podcasts that go too long sort of lose the thread, you know, inevitably. So let's try to like zoom in here on the end. How do you think this impacts 2020 elections?
You know what? I basically go back and forth. If you want me to pin me down on it, if I had to put money on it, I think if the riots go too long, let's say they go through the whole summer, I think they're going to be, I think the protests actually don't have an effect in a way.
Okay. So protests continue. They're generally peaceful. There's curfews. There's no riots. You know, this kind of thing.
Yeah. But if the riot, if the looting, if the violence and the fear of the violence continues to the end of the summer, I think it's bad for Trump against his baseline expectation. I think if they burn out and he somehow gains credit within the next couple of weeks, they could actually solidify a law and order, you know, plank for his campaign, perhaps. I mean, that's the traditional thing. Because I feel like right now, especially like some of the elite media, and I think this is particularly the elite media, it's not like the rank and file people, because I have friends that are academics that are terrified that like bought guns. Like they do support the protests, but whoever these looters are, and we don't really know. I think they're probably, frankly, just criminal elements and some people who really, like, you know, when you see people stacking up iPads, you know that they're not going to, like, use 10 iPads in their apartment. They're going to sell these, right? So this is like some sort of criminal enterprise here. So, you know, people
By the way, scared. I do wonder, Apple can lock each of those devices. They have the serial number of all the stock. Yeah. I don't really understand.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. So I don't know. I don't think criminals are not normally smart though. So I wondered that too. So I think like, you know, if it burns out soon, I think maybe that it can work out for Trump. I think on the whole, it's probably bad for him. On the whole. I mean, I think it's not going to be good for him, but.
Yeah, I think my take is that, you know, I don't see any way this goes well for Trump because this all happened under his watch. You know, the American carnage will end, right? Is what he said during what George W. Bush. So that's some weird shit, right? During the inauguration, after Trump started talking about carnage in the streets. Yeah. And yet as Trump has incited this, I mean, you know, it just boggles my mind that he or that anyone can think that protest, that the best way to suppress, to calm protests against oppression is by rubbing and screaming that they will be forcefully oppressed, like, and think that will not trigger defiance, and then that will not redouble it. I mean, that made me want to go out to every protest in New York. You know, it boggles my mind. So I think, hey, you know, this is all going to be tremendously bad for Trump and for, I mean, I think Senate, House. President's not in, right. I think clean sweep is not in question. And I think that raises, you know, especially at a time. Yeah.
I think that you're making a plausible case. It's probably where I lean. The only thing that I would say is I've seen some very, very tentative polls that a lot of people support things like the National Guard going out. I mean, you know, as you know, the history in the 60s, riots scare people. Silent majority is a thing. And if people are scared and they think that the Democrats are coddling, I guess this is the problem with I don't understand why some people in the media were minimizing the property crimes. Cause what they did is they erased the distinction between the protesters and the looters. I literally do not understand what was going through their heads when they did that. Cause I know they're partisan Democrats.
Well, see, I mean, I think this is where we part company a little bit, because I agree with you. It's just, I think you see this incredible bias, whereas I just see sort of laziness and a lack of critical thinking. No,
I mean, bias is not even like, I'm not saying it. It's just how it is.
And the ability to actually see that, hey, there are these different sort of things that are happening. And you know what? Like, I don't need, yeah. And I don't disagree with you. The media has done an atrocious job covering what's happening in America right now.
Because on Saturday, I think they realized that this property crime is getting out of control. And they were probably scared because it started getting out of the inner city and the downtown, like the ritzy, you know, urban cores, into other areas, which might affect them. And so then they started saying, well, it's white supremacists. You know what? This is like Jussie Smollett again, like MAGA hat wearing white supremacists in downtown Chicago. Okay, there's not that many white supremacists. And also, like, a lot of the looters, I mean, there are a variety of races. Perhaps there could be black white supremacists, but not huge gangs of them. You know, there are black ones, Latino ones, white ones, just judging, you know. Obviously, some of them were Antifa, but I don't think they're all Antifa. My personal opinion is I think they're criminal elements. But in any case, they're making all these conspiracy theories, and that makes it even more implausible. They eventually gave it up and tried to go to Antifa. But, like, just, like, say what you know. And if you don't know, don't say anything.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously, yeah. I mean, I think in my mind, it should have been covered as, hey, there are these protests. Cover the protests, talk about them, give numbers, all the rest. Then some of these protests did lead to some violent, you know, stuff, right? Like, and the like. Talk about that. Then separately, like the stuff that's happened on Fifth Avenue, those are not protests.
Those are not protests.
That's looting. And cover the looting completely separately. Talk about it in depth. Talk about the damage. Talk about the numbers. Talk, you know, but it's crazy. Instead, this has somehow been conflated or, as you said, ignored altogether and tried to be brushed under the rug by some outlets. And that's a, look, this is just, yeah, I mean, this is, why is the country in such bad shape? I mean, look, it's easy to just say, oh, the media sucks. I mean, there's lots of reasons why the media sucks right now. But yeah, this is not good.
Well, also, okay, one of the things is you can't brush it. I mean, there's live streams on Twitter. I mean, everything's being recorded. And so when they say, you know, when they say they're like white supremacists, and then like on your Twitter stream is a bunch of, you know, young black kids that are, you know, getting.
And vice versa. TVs. It's a bunch of black kids looting, right? And then you see white, you know, white antique
Which,
or white.
Exactly. Yeah, sure. And like, so, you know, we should close out, but I do want to say one of the things that did surprise me is these protests and some of the violence and the looting, when state cars get tagged in South Dakota, those are not black kids, you know. When there's like looting that's happening in the suburbs of Seattle, I mean, there are black people in Seattle, but like, you know, Seattle's Pacific Northwest. So it has spread. There is a level of economic immiseration, stress, generational alienation that we're seeing here. I think some of it is criminal elements, but you know, it is not just a black thing. It is broad based. I think that the killing of Lloyd and Black Lives Matter is something that people have glommed onto as kind of their flag, but that flag represents a lot of different things. And we have not even begun to really unpack that, because we're talking about racism, systemic racism, etc. And yes, I understand these people care about this, but ultimately, you know, as young white kids, that's symbolic for them. So why are they like putting their, frankly, their future on the line doing criminal activities? I think because they don't think they have a future. I think that they themselves feel like they are the oppressed of the world and the marginalized. And so it's easy for them to identify with this. Because in a way, it's them, even though it's not literally them. That's what I think.
Yeah, that's probably a good place to end. Razib, thanks for joining me on ABCD Politics. I don't think I've shared the name with you yet. both the play on, of course. Go ahead, Razib, explain ABCD.
American Born Confused Desi. Although I think we should drop the C because it's 2020, man, and you know, we're here.
Wow. Ready. Well, hold on. There's two parts to my name. The second part is like an A/B test. left, right. This is the ABC'd, C apostrophe seed of politics. What the other side is thinking, how this germinates into these wild, wild sort of, the other side obviously believes this, they hate me for this, or the like. Let's trace these back to this. So the ABC of politics. So ABCD politics. Tell your friends. Let's build up a following here. Let's have a place where people can actually listen to some civil discourse on what's happening and hear what the other side, even if we don't agree with them, is thinking.
For sure. And let's hope that we have a more positive episode next time, because the world is more positive.
Yes, that sounds great. Thanks again, Razib.
All right.